What was that? Sorry, I know you already said it once, but
Ramsey Lewis, Saturday Night After the Movies.
There you go, with the movie themed ear buddies on the way out, and we're gonna switch it up a little. But I haven't been to the movies in a long time, you know. It's just, I don't know, it's just expensive, and I don't know. Although my daughter wants to see the new Star Wars movie coming out. I don't remember, you know the name of that one? I don't either. I promised we'd go. So, yeah, that's something to look forward to for the holidays. And lots more debt, I guess. Whatever. So, yeah, you're about to hear some of that socialist alternative radio talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And I'll be your host today, Jeff. I think Diego couldn't make it in. Diego's our sometimes guest host. So, Diego, if you're out there, I hope you get a chance to listen. And this is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And we're a little slice of that community base for the next 2 hours every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Socialist Alternative Radio, yeehaw. And today we're going to be hitting it hard on healthcare and election stuff and, you know, some international, the revolts that are happening and big protest movements happening around the world. Right here, the labor movement, you know, picking up in militancy in terms of people willing to go on strike and so on, which is really good. And it's strikes that are victories, not just defensive strikes or partial victories instead of just all concessions. And that's great news. How deep that is, how far that is how far that goes is an open question, one that we want to talk about a little bit. We also have, you know, some, you know, go a little deeper into what is going on in the labor movement, in the union movement in the United States. And, you know, I realize a lot of our listeners aren't in unions, not your fault, probably, most likely. But I've worked at union and non-union. It's always better to work union, a lot better. Being a union factory worker when I was quite young allowed me to save enough money to go to college, actually. And when my family didn't have the money, and I didn't have the money, and I was able to, through having a union factory job, I was in the bakery workers union, I was able to pay tuition, and that combined with minimal loans compared to what people are facing now, and minimal scholarship because I wasn't all that smart, despite I thought I was, but anyway, so some scholarships, some loans, which actually the loans were minimal, but they still took me 13 years to pay off because I had very low paying jobs out of college. Anyone that tells you college is important to get a job, I think that's true in this society, and they're making it really, really hard, more and more difficult to attend college. They being big business, the corporations that run colleges for the most part. By the way, that term nonprofit, if you ever hear that associated with universities and colleges, it's completely meaningless. Completely meaningless. It's just a tax dodge. I work at Harvard University. I went to school at a big, expensive school. And I just don't want to give them publicity. I don't know why. I went to Boston University. There you go. Yay. I get this alumni stuff all the time. You're going to give money? No. Never going to give a penny. Because it took me 13 years to pay off my student loans. And they were minimal to Boston University. But I just had no money, you know. And I remember just, you know, my father had co-signed the loans and he was sweating it. And I don't blame him, you know. But I was able to make the payments, you know, by, you know, the typical, I don't know, not typical, but maybe it is typical. But it's back, you know, a while now, you know, living after college in crowded apartments and, you know, that kind of thing. And eating. What was that food I used to eat to save a lot of money? I would eat that like smoked salmon stuff and think I was getting some sort of my omega-3s or something. And smoked salmon's not good for you. Anything smoked is not good for you. I still eat it sometimes, but it's not good for you. I would eat that, I was a vegetarian off and on, but sometimes when I was eating meat, I would eat that like, I'd get like a ham steak or something. I felt like Popeye or something, eating my ham steak. Spam, you're thinking I was going to say Spam. I had Spam growing up as a kid. It was considered okay. It was considered a good sandwich, But at a certain point, I got completely turned off on it. I don't know why. I don't remember why exactly, besides the meat thing. And I think it's that jelly. Did you ever open the Spam and see that, like, there's this little jelly in it? That's kind of gross. That stuff's, I don't know if it's still like that. And then, living on the edge, rah-rah. I never got into the ramen noodle thing, which I guess saves a lot of money. That wasn't enough protein for me or something. But, so you live all those years paying off your student loans and you can't afford anything else. Or you go into debt, like I also did. You go into debt from debt. That's what people don't understand about not having money. Some people that have the money. Once you're in, you go into debt to survive. Then you go into more debt to deal with the debt and to survive. And it's this never-ending cycle that I've been unable to escape my entire life. And I have something related to that when you talk about medical care or the lack thereof or the crappiness of in the United States, about people going into debt for things that their insurance company should have covered. And instead they are, going, deeper into debt and... because they can't, the insurance company just all of a sudden refuses, changes their rules, changed the rules from last time, put it in the fine print, you know, that sort of thing. So that is, that's the deal with that. I'm having a little technical difficulty here. Oh, I see what it is. Okay. All right. There we go. Yeah. I just wanted to be able to hear myself a little better, and now I can. Great. Excellent. What else? Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to put on a quick song here because we like this. We like this. It's talking music, after all. Socialist Alternative Radio. And we've been playing a lot of album called The Prodigal Son by Rod Cooter. And we're going to continue that right now while I take care of some technical business. And let's see. We've played a lot from this. Let's try this one. Let's try this cut. See what happens. It's called Shrinking Man by Rod Cooter. We'll be right back.
When you're a shrinking man like me, worried man with a worried song, shrinking man ain't gonna be here long. Well, sometimes I worry about clothes. Shrinking man's gotta look good sometimes. Don't need no sweatshop chime. Putting shoes on my feet this time. Chained to a sewing machine. Down in hell where the sun don't shine. Look as good as you can. But please don't rob your fellow man. Shrinking man, shrinking man. Nobody was worried about a shrinking man. Sometimes I don't need much and I don't pay no starvation wage to poor folks out on a poison ground. You don't rob the land. Oh, when you're just that little old shrinking man. Shrinking man. Nobody was worried about a shrinking man. Worried
prayer. Cause a shrinking man better be a praying man. Once I had a dream, I was working. I had good ideas, I made big plans. Now I'm just like a leaf in the wind that's blowing. I hope King Jesus can understand. Shrinking man, shrinking man. Nobody was worried about a shrinking man. Worried man, or worried song. Shrinking man ain't gonna be here long.
Shrinking Man by Rye Cooter from the Prodigal Son, a new-ish album, 2018, Perro Verde Records, under exclusive license to Fantasy Records, a division of Concord Music Group, etc. Anyway, so Rye Cooter, Shrinking Man. Now you may ask yourself, or you may be asking me, that wasn't too political, was it? I don't know. Not really. I took a chance. I thought it was making that turn. I thought it was going to be about global warming and the effects of climate change caused by capitalist pollution and so on. But it turned into more of a personal thing, but that's okay. Anything to get you to listen to Rye Cooter, I guess, is the way we're going to go with that. So like I promised before, throwing on the music in order to take care of some paperwork here. Today's show, Social Alternative Radio, if you just tuned in, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, is going to be a lot about healthcare, a lot about a little bit about recent and current electoral, as in elections, stuff happening around the U.S., some international points about the protests, mass protests around the world that are happening right now in different countries. Not every country, not in every continent, but in a lot of different important countries, obviously. Some of them making it into the corporate press, some not. Corporate media, some not. A lot of stuff on the labor movement, if we have time, which I hope we do. And one of the things that made me want to talk about healthcare, which we could devote every minute of every show to here in the United States, every show of this program, Social Alternative Radio, because it's this crisis that just keeps getting worse, even as they say they're doing things. They, again, being big business, the government they control, the corporate-controlled U.S. government, the corporate-controlled political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, even as they say they're making reforms. Everyone from Trump to the people running for office, as Democrats say, they've done great things, they're going to do great things. Some of them defend Obamacare, which was a complete disaster and really cemented the relationship between capitalism, these private corporations, these insurance corporations, deathly, blood-sucking insurance corporations, and private hospitals, with people getting health care, you know. Just made that relationship even less regulated and more dependent, you know. It made it worse, basically. And there were some aspects of Obamacare that people will defend and say, well, it got more people on health insurance. You could, if you're 26 years or younger, stay on your parents' insurance and so on. That's good, okay? But it's very, very minimal, because when you look at the state of insurance companies putting their costs onto the people that need insurance, and insurance costs keep going up and up for people, that doesn't mean a hell of a lot, you know? So you're going to drive your parents into medical bankruptcy because the insurance companies are going to find a way to cover the cost of that 26-year-old or 25-year-old still on your plan, if they haven't already, You know, I mean, I can testify just the what you pay for insurance keeps going up and up and up, and the amount that you get back from insurance keeps getting smaller and smaller and less, the services you get are less and less. I owe $50 right now for an MRI. I used to be able to get MRIs for free. You know, I've never actually needed an MRI before. I think it was my first MRI ever. And, or maybe I needed them and didn't get them or whatever, which is another thing, people putting off healthcare because of the cost. And all of a sudden I'm slapped with a $50 bill. And I work at a company that, you know, Harvard University that has unions. I'm in a union. My union has given concessions on healthcare, which is part of why I had to pay for an MRI, which is horrible. But by some people's standards, oh, you have health insurance. Oh, you're in a union with that, you know, can negotiate potentially better health care, although they don't. I mean, even when we got in, we had Momentum way back in the late 80s. I helped organize the union there along with a lot of other people. And we had Momentum going in, having won that victory, and Harvard management thinking they were going to have to deal with a real union with a lot of fight in it. And instead ending up with a company union that just keeps giving concessions for no reason to the richest corporation in the world, practically, or one of the richest corporations in the world, the biggest, the richest university in the world, one of the richest corporations in the world. And so these concessions on healthcare are just killing me and my family, you know, and they're completely unnecessary, 110% unnecessary. But that's tip of the iceberg, right? Many, many, many insurance companies, many, many places where people have insurance through the employer, and that's a devil's bargain set up back in the 50s and 60s, unfortunately, although it was more heavily regulated in the 50s and 60s due to heavy regulation, and because that the balance of power was less unequal than it is now in the United States, where the unions had more power, the corporations were afraid of workers more, the Soviet Union existed, the Stalinists, which I'm not defending there, the Stalinist regimes that claimed to be communist, they really weren't, but they were a pressure on somewhat of a pressure on capitalism in the U.S. to cough up some concessions. And still, I mean, there's really limits to that, because there you had Europe outstrip the United States and start getting national health care for its citizens starting in the post-war upswing for all of its citizens. And just about every European country, I think every European country I can think of, has a much better health care, some sort of national health care, some sort of universal insurance coverage, heavily regulated. So to the point where even in Canada as well, 1964 started the move towards and got universal health care. And the United States, despite the concessions or because of the concessions, actually by the labor movement and of course the relentless, power and profit grabs of big business, of the big corporations, they kept promising, oh, this system will be better, this will work better, and they gave some concessions in the beginning, in the 50s and 60s, in terms of heavy regulation, you know, of insurance companies. So, for example, you had tons of people on Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and heavily regulated hospitals mostly, I have to check on this historically, but there was definitely a lot of hospitals that were heavily regulated, municipal hospitals and so on, that were more trying to provide a service than make profits. And of course, that nothing is static under capitalism or any system really, but under capitalism particularly, what you win, what little reform you win one day can be taken away in the next second. And seeing more money to be made from healthcare, the corporations moved in, deregulated. You had HMOs, the horror of you know, HMOs come up. Companies, you know, through deregulation and through a weakening labor movement, offloading costs onto workers. Many companies not providing health care insurance, and that was like almost a quid pro quo. Sorry to use that term if you're following the impeachment proceedings back in the 50s and 60s. A lot of things came together to really hurt the average person, most working people. And I can hear somebody saying, well, you know, my health care has worked out really good, and I don't want to risk that. I'd like to sit down and really discuss what's really good means, okay? Your expectations, like most people in America, are probably ridiculously low when it comes to health care. And the fact that you're paying anything at all for it is ridiculous and absurd. And compared to other countries, even under capitalism, it's absurd. The money is there for healthcare, easily there, through taxing the corporations more. They're hardly paying any taxes now. Taxing the super rich, they're hardly paying any taxes now, relatively speaking to us, working people. And to cut the military spending, which is just there really to be the muscle for capitalism, for big businesses to make sure they get the trade agreements they want, make sure they get access to cheap labor and cheap natural resources they want so they can continue to make profits off of our labor and off of our planet, off of nature, in the most horrible ways, the most polluting and rotten ways, because it's short-term maximization of profit. That's all that matters to big corporations. That is God. Short-term maximization of profit. You think anything else matters more? You're living in a dream world. You're living in a fantasy. You're some sort of libertarian idiot, because corporations are not there. They're never there. Deval Patrick just went and made a speech before the Democrats. He's an ex-governor of Massachusetts. He was a complete horror show when he was governor, for as far as working people go. And now he's going to run for president. He spent his years after, of course, this happens all the time. It's called the revolving door. If you take any sociology class in college, he went from corporate background into politics, and now he's worked for Bain Capital since he retired as governor. Just like the president of Harvard who just retired, Drew Faust, she's now working for Goldman Sachs. You know, the level of corruption, the level of greed, the level of, you know, machine profit making over everything else. And by machine, I'm trying to explain like a process that doesn't matter if you think you're personally a morally good person or you think this company is company X is morally good. They never are, ultimately. They can't be and survive under capitalism. So Deval Patrick got up and made that speech, though, that, oh, I worked for the part of Bain Capital that had some socially good corporation. No such thing as a socially good corporation. Even if the product or service that a corporation is churning out based on our labor and exploitation of our planet, again, that is still tainted by that process. Do you understand? Even if they're producing, you know, lollipops or you know, wonderful smelling roses, you know, I mean, or something like a new technological advance in healthcare, a new drug. Well, if you take 2 seconds to look at that process, look at the price of that new drug, you know, take any kind of minute to examine how this could be done a million different ways better than through private enterprise, which is just private greed made God again, made the religion, really, of the country, then you know this is really not a good thing. You know, people have to start being able to, you know, I heard someone say, this is an old cliche by now, but, you know, hold two contradictory thoughts in their mind at once. That, yes, I could say I'm grateful. I'm a cancer survivor. I'm grateful for the new anti-cancer drug that kind of helped me survive cancer for now. I'm grateful for that. That's a good thing. You can have that in your head, right? And at the same time say, but the way that drug was produced, the amount of money it costs, the fact that a lot of people aren't going to be able to afford it or get it, the fact that it's, you know, it's random almost. Well, it's not random. It's based on money and marketing and so on, which is based on money. Who's going to actually have access to that drug? That everyone can't get that drug that needs it in the world at the same time. You can say there's 50 negatives for that one positive that I'm grateful that I'm living. A bunch of other people aren't going to survive that cancer because they're not going to have access to that drug. It's going to be too expensive. And we're going to get into that. We're going to show you evidence of that. People that had thought they had access to this or that, they ended up not getting it, etc. So there was one other point I was going to make there. Oh yeah, I'll just skip that. It was going to be I was going to do a little riff on the impeachment stuff. By the way, if you're wondering why we're not spending all our time talking about the impeachment you know, programs and shows and the impeachment show, why we're not talking about that a lot on Social Alternative Radio is because we're not liberals, you know? We're not liberals here. We're not conservatives. We're not libertarians. We're not liberals. We are about fundamental social change to democratic socialism, to a society where you know, goods and services, commodities of all sorts, things that you need, things that you want, are produced in a way that is actually based on democratic decision-making on a mass scale. So you bring democracy into the economy, you produce what people decide they want and need. That can include luxuries, it can include absolutely essential things, if we all decide we want those things, and how to produce those things sustainably so it's not hurting the environment, and how our labor to control our own labor can be done in a way where we have good lives, decent lives, better lives, more leisure time, use of technology that doesn't destroy jobs, because your life won't depend on that one job. It will be part of a figuring out how to move forward altogether with the jobs, different types of jobs that we need, with training and education and whatever, not to those that can pay for it, but to everyone that wants it, and figure out how to use our labor based on how we want to labor, you know, controlling the results of that labor, not going to profit for a few, but going back into the all the things we need to have that better life. So, for example, we decided as a society, not just here in the United States, but internationally, we want more leisure time to be able to figure things out, to be able to make decisions about local, regional, national, international things that are related to economic production, you know. And it's not rocket science a lot of the time. It's like, you know, there's X number of steel mills in the world. How many do we really need at this point in time? And where should they be so they cause the least damage? And how can they be built so they cause the least damage? And putting those decisions to elected representatives of organizations, of governments, workers' governments, not the same kind of government we have now, which is run by the big corporations, and then deciding how to go forward there. And so the resources that come out of that can go back into more leisure time, more time to decide things, more the machinery, whatever the infrastructure you would need for that decision making, but also for human needs, for housing, for clothing, for food that's not going to make you obese, or at the same time not be available because it keeps going up in cost. The worst of both worlds, for example, in American cuisine, quote unquote. Anyway, let's get into that healthcare talk about discussion. Analysis, I remember my point. I'm sorry, my point was a simple one that I've skipped earlier. News came out the last 24 hours on the corporate media that Elizabeth Warren is refining her. She's one of the people running for as a Democrat, the Democratic Party primary, and she's refining her healthcare plan now to say, well, this will take 3 years. There will be the reform of some sort of public option for poor people and children. Now, that definition of who's poor in America is always really not done well. You know, you have to be like dirt poor, incredibly poor, to get anything. And then you just get scraps. So I'm really curious what the definition of poor would be for any kind of plan coming out of the Democrats. And then you got in the third year, and this is assuming, of course, that it passes, that the Democrats vote for it, the Republicans vote for it, if there's any Republicans left. Having a majority anywhere, and like in the Senate or the House, and so they assumes like things are passing, right? So the third year, then it would be some sort of universal health care or Medicare for all, quote unquote. And if you were listening to the show, I mean, we've talked about how Medicare for all is a problematic way to describe what's necessary, which is basically free health care for everyone, you know. Also known as universal health care. It's really hard to come up with good, or it seems to have been hard to come up with good, labels for basically everyone, health care is a human right, everybody should have it, it should be free. Boom. Now you can quibble with the word free. Would that be increased taxes? Well, increased taxes on the super rich, and on the big corporations, cutting military spending, cutting corporate welfare subsidies, yeah, you know, meaning subsidies to big business. There's some money there, but it's not money coming out of working class, because we're taxed to death already. Our taxes have to go down, way down. It's like the last program I mentioned, and this popped up again in the corporate media. Around here, it's basically gridlock now, coming into Boston and leaving Boston every single workday, and it's hell. It's really, it's not just like this, oh, it gives me a headache, the traffic. No, it's dangerous. Like, the number of accidents happening is incredible. The number of people, I drive all the time, the number of people pulling in front of cars that they wouldn't have done 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Like there's a line of traffic. The number of people that pull out in front of a car in a dangerous manner instead of waiting for a gap in the traffic has increased exponentially. No one's talking about it except for me and my family because we notice it. We're just like, I can't believe they just did that. They just pulled in front of that car. There was no room. That could have been a horrible accident. And we've seen two accidents now from that. People pulling out into traffic where there wasn't enough time, enough room to pull into the line of traffic. They do this. Well, I won't say they all do it because of this reason, but I would argue they do this because they're tired. They you can actually wait for like 5 minutes sometimes, maybe longer, for a gap in traffic. And this could be a road that's not even a highway. You know, it's where people are trying to get around the highway. The Mass Pike is useless. You know, the commute that I have to make every day to work should be on the Mass Pike. I've discovered it's completely useless for that commute. Wasn't that way 2 years ago. I could you know, barely use it and get in. Now it's completely useless because I will be stuck definitely in traffic for much, much longer than the commute should take. And I'm talking about an hour longer, hour and a half longer. You know, it's absurd now. And you just if you don't believe me, turn on the traffic reports, you know. Mass Pike blocked from 495 to Newton Corner. 495, Newton Corner. 495, Newton Corner. That's a big stretch of road. And that's a stretch of road. When they say blocked, that means you just sit there for a long time. Then you go forward a little bit. Number of fender benders increases. Number of people doing crazy things to get around the traffic increases. And so there's this traffic nightmare. You can't afford commuter rail. It's too expensive. Commuter rail sucks. Doesn't run enough. It's already crowded, overcrowded. They've privatized it. There's a private company running it. That should never happen, right? Needed public services should never be in the hands of private corporations because sooner or later, they're going to cut service to make money. It's that simple. So we've seen these things recently in the corporate media and commuter rail, these egregious egregious safety violations of like a door open for like a big chunk of the commuter rail trip the other night. That was on the news. The door was open. People are trying not to get sucked out of the train. People are taking pictures of it with their phone. And then the company, the private corporation, has the gall, the corporate greed gall, to blame it on the passengers. Oh, someone must have left the door open. No, you've been cutting back on staff. We know you have. You've been cutting back on workers that used to be in charge of closing the train doors and stuff. And they have to go around and collect money from people and check their passes and all that. It's completely insane to have public transit in the hands of private people. A little clique, a little cabal, a little oligarchy of greedy idiots that don't even probably know anything about public transit. They just want to make money off it. It's the latest company they bought up. Then they hire someone to go in, but they don't hire the smartest people, whatever that means. They don't hire the person most interested in public transit to run the show. They hire someone that has a record in public transit of probably cutting it, right? They hire someone who has a record in public transit, if one at all, of cutting service, of making it more quote-unquote efficient. Whenever you hear the word efficient, you know, it's time to get out your proverbial shotgun, you know, I'm using a metaphor here, and just, you know, get ready for battle because this is crazy, you know? The efficiency under capitalism means things that hurts working people, hurts quality, it hurts workers, it hurts nature. Because efficiency just means doing things at lower cost for more profit. And to get lower costs, you want less environmental regulation. You want to cut, lay people off and have fewer staff, fewer workers do more work until it's dangerous, till it's hurting your health, et cetera, et cetera. You know, anything you can do. Now, sometimes it's not, you can say to me, you can argue back, well, it's not always that way. No, it's not always that way. Sometimes when the labor movement is on the offensive, when there's a big socialist movement, people fight back, right? And they get some concessions. But under capitalism, that's just temporary. So for a while, you know, there's certain regulations that, and the unions are strong enough, and the workers' parties and socialist movement is strong enough, communist movement, whatever, and it makes the corporations duck down. They can't lay as many people off as they want, or they can't lay people off, right? The union got a good contract, no layoff clause in the good contract, can't lay people off. My union, by the way, does not have a no layoff clause, never had one, never even thought of having one, doesn't believe in it, actually. Lets the corporation, because they believe in partnership with management, let the corporation lay people off. So I meet the Walking Dead, basically. Dead, you know, what's the show I watch? The Walking Dead, right? Okay, that's the title of it. I'm spacing on the title of a show I've watched many times. I run into people, especially people in their 40s or 50s, because of the rampant age discrimination happening. But age discrimination doesn't mean that you got laid off by some institution or person necessarily that looks at you and says, "Oh, your wrinkles are showing. You know, you're getting a little flabby. We're gonna toss you now." It's not that. Per se, it's not a cosmetic, superficial thing, or even a conscious thing. It is, oh, you've been here X amount of time, you're making more money in your pathetic little salary than the next pathetic little salary person is making, so let's get rid of you, and that will make more profit for the corporation. And that is the game at Harvard, a so-called nonprofit, as much as anywhere else. So you get into your 40s or 50s, and it's Hunger Games time, or whatever you want to call it. It's, you know, who are we going to maneuver to lay off? Because they've stuck around this hellhole to end up making a bearable, slightly bearable, barely bearable living for themselves, and we got to get rid of that stuff, because we basically want everyone to be a temp, and we want everyone to be on a schedule that we decide week by week, et cetera, et cetera. Some of the stuff that people are already facing in retail and so on. I mean, I've had friends and comrades and union sisters and brothers and so on working or seeing people work, not so much union sisters and brothers, but seeing people work in these 7-Elevens and all that kind of stuff, you know, those kind of retail, that level of retail where it's largely almost probably completely unorganized into unions, where they're just basically, they just yank your chain, man, every day. Don't come in today. Come in today. Come in for 3 hours. No, you don't make enough hours to qualify for our benefits we don't really give to anybody. I mean, it's like Walmart on steroids, you know? Because Walmart, this big, ugly, horrible corporation like Amazon, right? They have horrible, horrible, horrible labor stuff they do to workers, you know? I was going to say like labor relations or relationship with labor. I don't know why I'm being so fancy. They just hurt people, right? They exploit the hell out of people. They exploit labor. They exploit your labor time. They exploit your labor power. And they just go after you nastily, nastily, nastily. Look at what's been happening in the Amazon warehouses. They're like sweatshops. So basically, you have the situation where like in Amazon and Walmart, they still have this kind of little bit of public persona they want to maintain, public image they want to maintain. So when these things hit the corporate media, then there might be a little tiny bit of change, never nearly enough, never saying, hey, organize a union or bring a union in here, never that. It's always, you know, little, too late, and then they'll get rid of it as soon as the glare of the spotlights is gone from the corporate media or whatever, or the alternative media or protesters or whatever. So then you have, but then you have these places that are more under the radar, you know, Cumberland Farms or 7-Eleven or whatever, Dunkin' Donuts, although sometimes you hear about the stuff they do. These places that are you know, not as much in the spotlight, not as well known as like McDonald's or something, you know. And this isn't a pass towards McDonald's or anything, because they're all up and evil too. But these places like these little convenience stores, but they're part of chains and so on, you know, they just want to really mess with you. You know, they just want to like eke out every last penny, even more than the, well, I don't want to say even more, but they just, you know, they're just, you know, there's no schedule. You just come in when we want, you know, you do this dangerous stuff. You do all this stuff. Minimum wage, minimum wage, minimum wage, a few cents over minimum wage. But if you're lucky, you know, just nasty to the workers. I mean, a horrible, no benefits. It's just horrible. It's just really, really horrible, you know. Anyway, and you're not getting health insurance on top of it all, of course. And you can't afford anything, basically, except try to, you know, what you can do is you can try to work another job or two. And you're going to run into the same problems with those jobs as well. And there's no way to get enough flexibility in your schedule usually to even do that. Anyway, we started out riffing on the problems with public transit. That can be a problem for people that make nothing as well. It's unaffordability. And what I was getting into, get back around to the point, thank you. The point is that still, for the second time in a row, I heard on the corporate media the solution to this from some right-wing think tank or something, or maybe it's liberal think tank because they think the same way about this kind of stuff. The right-wingers, the conservatives, and the liberals. Our solution is to tax, to have a gas tax. We're gonna put in a 25-cent gas tax. I hear this, and I just, my head wants to explode, you know? And they wonder why people then are going to vote for Trump or something. I mean, what the hell? Not that Trump will do the same thing, but he'll, like, at least he'll have some rhetoric against it. You know, the Trump regime, as they say in the corporate media, knows its base. They know what lines to throw out to fool people. While it's going to be really easy for some Trumpo or some Trump-like character to rail against a 25-cent increase in gas tax or whatever they're proposing, 26 cents or whatever. It doesn't matter if it's 1 cent more. There's already 18 cents of every dollar you pay, at least, I think it's 18, probably more, going to get gas tax. Then there's other, I think, taxes on that as well. So, look, hey, I don't want to drive a car if I didn't have to, but I have to, you know? And anyone who wants to talk about that, fine, we can talk about it. I'll show you my family. I'll show you our schedule. I'll show you how much commuter rail costs versus how much a car costs. You know, even though cars are getting ridiculously expensive to buy, even used ones, and maintain, and gas, you know, it's still actually cheaper than a lot of public transit, you know, depending on what you need, you know. But it's for many people, it's cheaper. And if it's not cheaper, it's not that much more than public transit, right? I mean, they just could keep raising the T-fares. Cut the crap. That stuff should be free, you know? There are people around the country raising free transit now in cities, and it's being taken seriously. People don't quite know how to organize for it, and they're not being mobilized and organized in any coherent way, unfortunately, by the people that might say it's a good thing. That's got to be learned, or they got to put their money where their mouth is and actually do the organizing. But it's a thing now. It's a thing. Free transit. So I hear these people say, hey, we're going to raise, you know, we're going to raise money for some unspecified public transit, which would just be more like make money off you transit, not really public transit, profit transit, not public transit. There's got to be, we have to, you know, I'm going to trademark that right now. I don't even believe in trademark to a certain extent, but they do in some cases. But anyway, trademark that. Public transit versus private transit. Profit transit versus public transit, right? That's what we're up. That's what it has to come down to. That's what the battle has to come down to. And we have to win public transit. We have to win public transit, which will not be private transit. It will not be profit transit. That's what we have to fight for. Otherwise, this mess and the horrible expense of getting into work and turning down jobs. How many people turn down jobs because of the commute is unbearable? It's, you can't do it. And the cost of the transportation is unbearable. You can't do it. There's lots of people that can't take jobs. All this thing about there's jobs out there. Yeah, well, why should I take a job where it costs me more to commute to the job than I'm going to get back, you know, in wages? Because I'm working, say I'm working part-time or something, or there's other factors involved. It's just like the childcare equation now in America, here in America, basically, if you want childcare, you can't dump your kids on your grandparents, or your parents, I'm sorry, or your grandparents, whatever the case may be. And that's, you know, that's okay. I don't blame people that do that. I would love to be able to do that, but many people can't do that, right? They live far away. They don't live anymore. They're not alive anymore. You can't do it. You just can't do it. And or they're not capable of doing it, of taking care of your kids. So then you're in the market. Well, that's, in America, people have to understand, don't grow up here. The market is now a nice word to a lot of people. It sounds nice. It sounds like you're going shopping on a Saturday to, buy chocolates and honey in the local medieval market. The market is supposed to bring up, you know, an image of like bucolic, semi-rural stalls, you know, with happy, chubby storekeepers. Selling their handmade wares, you know. Of course, the real market is 190,000% not that. It is completely, you know, big corporations, taking over every small corporation or small company or small artisan that sticks their head above a certain level, then they're going to get picked off, they're going to get bought off, or they're going to get forced out of business when they enter the real market, which is just about monopolization, concentration of capital, all that stuff that Marxism analyzes and writes about, and you should read about it too, you know. And the real market is hell. The real market is exploiting labor, and as much as labor as it can. There was a kid, did you see that corporate media report of a kid working in a Popeye's chicken, 8-year-old kid, making sandwiches in front of the hot burners and all that. This is an anomaly right now, I hope. I'm told it is. And that's one reason it made the corporate media. But there was a time under capitalism where that was the norm. Child labor was the norm. Right? There's a time under the beginnings of capitalism where capitalism and slavery existed, not only existed, but profited from one another. There's no bottom line for the capitalists. They'll do anything. They'll destroy the planet, you know, eventually through nuclear war or environmental degradation, you know, global warming and all that, to keep the profit system going. That's what they will do. They've shown they're fully capable of doing that, and that's all that matters, and that's the bottom line. So, when a problem comes up in society, like the gridlock in Boston, we're just going to tax the crap more out of these workers that we already exploit, you know, and we're going to just suck the wealth that they create, that we create with our labor, and by labor I mean brain labor as well as physical labor, or the combination of the two, and they're going to suck that wealth out into more and more into their pockets. So now we have this incredible inequality in the United States, despite an economy of relatively low unemployment for the last whatever years, four years, and or a little bit more maybe, and despite that, there's all these economic problems at the level of the working class in terms of huge levels of homelessness, huge levels of bankruptcy, indebtedness, things that people are told they need and that in fact they really do need to a certain extent, like send your kid to college if you have kids, and that's gone up. I read these statistics. I mean, please fact check these, but I'm not far off. 500% increase within a few years. I mean, you've got colleges talking about now openly. A bunch of colleges. I think the one I remember is University of Chicago saying they're going to start charging $100,000 just for tuition alone starting next year. And if you know anything about college, don't blame me if you don't. It's really expensive. Few and fewer people are going to know anything about college in the future in this country. Real college or college, you know, 4-year, college, intensive college or whatever you want to call it. There's also a board. They call it board. That's rent. They charge you to stay in a crappy little room somewhere. Or I hear some of the rooms are getting nicer. I'll believe it when I see it. So it's not just tuition. It's also tuition and room and board. And room is rent. Board is crappy food that you get and pay way too much for. Or you can ditch that and try to get an apartment in a really expensive city. Live with, you know, 4 or 5 other students in a crowded, overcrowded apartment in a really expensive city with probably all sorts of issues of personal safety and so on. But it's always comes back to what more can we extract from the working class in terms of labor power, in terms of labor time, in terms of taxation, in terms of consumerism, and it's not the answer. And in fact, there is no answer under capitalism. For a lot of the problems we talk about, there is no answer under capitalism. Even countries, for example, that have national health care for now, most of their history, they didn't have it, and it's being messed with even as we speak. It is being underfunded, and they're trying really hard in a lot of countries to might be under the table or under the radar, but they're trying really hard to get rid of national health care, to undermine it. Now, in this country, we don't even have that yet, and yet somehow we're still the greatest country in the world, quote unquote, ad nauseum. The greatest country in the world has the following headline to think about if you believe the propaganda of greatest country in the world. This is from, I believe it's from The Guardian, November 14th, headline. This is under I guess they have a regular feature of U.S. healthcare. Someday, if things go well, if we have socialism in the future, we'll have, like, you know, the Holocaust Museum or the museum that opened up about slavery in the United States. We'll have a museum about healthcare under capitalism, and you know, other horrific you know, museum themes, themed museums out there will exist as well. But one's got to go to healthcare under capitalism. And really make it clear, which is not to a lot of people now, that they don't care if you live or die. They really don't. They really don't. Remember that George Carlin, the comedian, towards the end of his life, I forget when he died, it was in the 2000s, I think. He got really, really honest with his audience. And he was, you know, he was a bit of a nihilist. He didn't really have any... or nihilist, however you say that. He didn't really have any solutions to offer that I could figure out. But he certainly knew how to point out the problems in a more and more honest way from a working class perspective. And he basically said, you know, they're in a big club, meaning, you know, the big corporations, the rich, they're in a club, and you're not in it. And in his show, he would emphasize that point. He would just say, that's a big club out there, the rich and the big corporations, that you're not in it. Then he would say, you're not in it. You're not in it. You're not. He would repeat it over and over again. And I really understood that. I really felt that, because what he's saying is he's trying to emphasize a point that a lot of people just don't get. And I don't blame them for not getting it, because everything we're taught, you know, in the corporate media and in school and everything, we're just waiting in line to be the next, you know, rich and powerful corporate executive. We're going to, you know, work our way up, blah, blah, blah. Statistically, that's a myth. The vast, vast, vast majority of people, I'm talking about really huge disparity in the number of corporate elite powerful people in the United States and the number of people in the United States. Even if you want to break that down and get rid of parts of the population, statistically get rid of parts of the population that wouldn't be in that situation, and you still have you still have odds that are like winning the lottery odds. You know, you have odds that are like worse than winning the lottery odds in some cases. You have odds that just make it, of course, an impossibility, you know, for people. And then once you're there, you're just, in your own way, a tool, you know. Like, I feel like I'm a tool because I got to go to work to survive. I'm coerced into that work or die thing that under capitalism everyone feels to one extent or another. And yet, I could be at the top. That's what one of the things about capitalism, not a thing we talk about a lot because the way it doesn't matter, but I could be at the top and I'm still a tool. I'm a tool of the system. I'm just running it from the top, or I'm hiring others to run it from the top and gathering more lucre, more wealth from the work of others than I could ever spend in a million lifetimes. And that's one of the absurdities of capitalism, is that the capitalists themselves are chained to their own system if they want to stay capitalists, you know. If they want to quit tomorrow, certainly they've done a lot of damage, and they're bringing blood money with them into their nice retirement, but it's better than, like, refreshing the automatic exploitation of capitalism on a daily basis of labor, of our work, and of our planet, of our environment, and using those things to make profit for an elite few, and I'm talking few, very, very tiny percentage of the population. So here we go, quote, I live on the street now, how Americans fall into medical bankruptcy. Having health insurance is often not enough to save Americans from massive debts when serious illness strikes. So I'm going to quote from this article a bit by Michael Sainatow, Sainato, I believe it was from The Guardian, from Thursday, November 14th, 2019. I made this complaint before. I gather articles together to talk about as part of the show, and I hit the print thing, right? And they come out printed, but somehow in the print, I don't know why the companies would want to do this, but in the print way it prints out, you lose the title of the publication it comes from. If I was one of these, people making up the website or whatever, I would or the Facebook page, I would, you know, try to like keep the name of the publication in with the text, wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't that make sense? And yet a lot of them I have to write it in, or I don't have time, and I just whatever. So this one I think is from The Guardian, the guy I mentioned already, and it's a good article though. It says, quote, like I said, having health insurance is often not enough to save Americans from massive debts when serious illness strikes. You don't even have to put the word serious in there, but whatever. Quote, it's been over a dozen years since Suzanne LeClaire of West Palm Beach, Florida, West Palm Beach, not a bad address, right, was first diagnosed with cancer, and she's been fighting it ever since. So over a dozen years. Now she, like many other Americans facing life-threatening illness, is bankrupt despite having health insurance. As we've said on the show before, when we talked about health insurance, check out that movie, even though it's now been, you know, it was made in the 90s. I think it was 90s. Check out the movie Sicko by Michael Moore. Michael Moore has lost it. He's just liberal now. He's just a liberal supporting any Democrat that comes along and he thinks is progressive. He used to be for trying to get a Labor Party off the ground, at least for a short time in his life. And he used to put out movies that were hard-hitting on the system and not trying to be popular. His politics, I don't think, was ever that coherent, but it was there. He had the right instincts, I think. And Sicko's his best movie I've ever seen, at least. I've seen most of his stuff. Because it talked about, it was critical of U.S. healthcare, but from the perspective of people that already had health insurance and were still getting completely screwed over to the point of being murdered, really, by the system. To the point of actually being killed, you know? So, anyway, this is what this article is about, essentially. And I'm not going to have time to go into all the stuff in it, but there's some pretty compelling stories. I mean, a lot of corporate journalism, and even this is still corporate journalism in a certain sense, but let's say alternative journalism, tries to bring you in through personal stories. And I like that. I understand that. But sometimes I don't like it. You know, sometimes I just want, hey, just give me the facts. I don't need the personal story up front. That's, you know, we can add that, you know, and that's great. And people need to hear about it. And the people want to tell their stories a lot of the time. That's great. But we're not so ignorant as working people that we can't handle, you know, the straight up, you know, facts, you know, the hard liquor, you know. We can handle that. All right. So anyway, before her cancer-related surgery, this is Suzanne LeClaire of West Palm Beach, Florida, LeClaire was told by the hospital that they accepted her employer-based health insurance. Wish they would out the employer here, the company. Anyway, and she says, I paid my $300 copay. Can you believe that? $300 copay? $300 is a fee tacked on to the amount you're already paying in insurance every month. Comes out of your check if you don't have that. If you don't know about that, comes out of your check. After the surgery, back to quoting, after the surgery, I started receiving all these invoices, meaning bills, and came to find out the only thing covered was my bed because the hospital was out of network. Out of network is another fancy term for this insurance company just decided not to deal with this hospital or vice versa, right? They didn't want to deal with insurance or whatever. Now, shouldn't there be a law that says every hospital has to deal with every kind of health insurance? Of course there should be, right? Well, until we get rid of health insurance, which is a scam. By the way, all insurance is a scam. Think about insurance. I mean, anybody that owns anything, it's a scam. You're always paying more in than you get back. Always, always, always. Do we have to have situations where, do we have to have a system where every thing that goes wrong, you need insurance for? They have rental insurance now. They have travel insurance now. Of course you don't. You don't have to have that. You have corporate liability. You have corporations have to pay when something goes wrong, or the government has to pay when something goes wrong. You don't have to have insurance, which is basically other people's money and your money poured into an insurance company, and then every once in a great while when they can't squirm out of it, they'll pay something to you. You know, if you work for an insurance company, say, that's not how it works. We're really good people. You're not good people. I'm sorry. Just face reality. Insurance is a scam. You know it's a scam. I'm not blaming you if you have to get a job in the insurance industry at a low level. Insurance executives, yeah, they should be in prison, but the average worker, right, insurance business, no, I'm not saying you're doing a bad thing at all. You have to survive, but you don't have to sugarcoat it. You don't have to say that people paid insurance all their lives and never, maybe never get back.